Instead of picking pockets on my own, I was soon stripping whole crowds of citizens with my gangmates, along with waylaying delivery vans and lifting whatever we could from stores and warehouses. Sure, I'd get caught sometimes, but generally I'd get released, too, because we were such a big team, it was generally pretty hard for a prosecutor to make a charge stick to just one of us. On top of that, I was only 11, and I could usually play the innocent orphan when I needed to. But the judge I got that one day at Jefferson Market, he wasn't buying any acts or any excuses. The cops had nailed me for breaking a store dick's leg over at B. Altman's joint on 19th Street while me and the gang were picking shoppers' pockets. I could usually control my trademark weapon better than that. I generally try to leave a nasty bruise instead of a break. But the store detective had me by the throat, and I was that close to choking. So quick as spit, there I found myself in the main courtroom at Jefferson Market getting one hell of a lecture as I sat under the tall turret of the courthouse's fine clock tower. The old windbag on the bench called me everything from a nicotine fiend — I'd been smoking since I was 5, to a drunkard, which showed how much he knew. I never touched the stuff — to a congenitally destructive menace, a phrase which, at the time, meant a whole lot of nothing to me, but which was, as it turned out, destined to be the key to my salvation. You see, it happened that a certain crusading mental specialist with a particular interest in children was just outside the courtroom that day, waiting to testify in another case. And when the judge let out with that congenital phrase and then went on to sentence me to 2 years on Randall's Island, I suddenly heard a voice rise from somewhere behind me. I'd never heard anything quite like it. Certainly not in a courtroom, anyway. Tinged with a combination of German and Hungarian accents, it rolled with all the thunder and righteousness of an old-time preacher. "And precisely what," the voice demanded, "are your honor's qualifications for coming to so precise a psychological conclusion concerning this boy?" At that point, all eyes, including mine, turned to the back of the courtroom to get a glimpse of what was, for most of them, a familiar sight. The renowned alienist, Dr. Laszlo Kreitzler, one of the most hated yet respected men in the city, charging in, his long hair and cloak floating behind him, and his eyes burning with coal-black fire. I had no way of knowing that one day I'd become accustomed to that sight, too. All I knew then was that he was the damnedest person with the damnedest nerve that I ever saw. The judge, for his part, put his forehead into his hand wearily for a moment, like the good Lord had just sent a rain of toads down on his little patch of earth in particular. "Dr. Kreitzler," he started, but the doctor already had an accusing finger up. "Has an assessment been done? Has one of my esteemed colleagues given you any reason for using such language? Or have you, like most other magistrates in this city, simply decided that you are qualified to speak expertly on such matters?" "Dr. Kreitzler," the judge tried again, but with no better luck. "Do you have even the slightest idea of what the symptoms of what you call congenital destructiveness are? Do you even know if such a pathology exists? This insufferable, unqualified, inflammatory rhetoric, Dr. Kreitzler," the judge bellowed, slamming a fist down, "this is my courtroom. You have nothing to do with this case. And I demand..." "No, sir," the doctor shot back. "I demand... you have made me a part of this case, myself and any other self-respecting psychologist who is within earshot of your irresponsible declarations. This boy..." At that he pointed in my direction and, for the first time, actually looked at me. And I'm not sure I'm up to describing all that was in the look. His eyes sparkled with a message of hope, and the smallest, quickest smile told me to have courage. All in a rush, and for the first time in my life, I felt like someone over the age of 15 truly gave a good goddamn about my existence. You don't really know that you've been living without that commodity until someone makes you aware of the possibility of it. And when they do, it's a very peculiar sensation. The doctor's face went straight and stern again as he snapped back around to the judge. "You have said that this boy is a congenitally destructive menace. I demand that you prove that assertion. I demand that he be given a new hearing, conditional upon the findings of at least one qualified alienist or psychologist." "You can demand anything you like, sir," the judge responded, "but this is my court, and my ruling stands. Now kindly await the call of the case for which you have been retained, or I'll hold you in contempt." A bang of the gavel, and I was on my way to Randall's Island. but as I left the courtroom I looked again to the mysterious man who had appeared, out of thin air it seemed to me at the time, to take up my cause. He returned the look with an expression which said the matter was far from settled. And so it was. 3 months later, inside my leaky brick cell in the main block of the boys' house of refuge, I had that encounter with a guard what I've mentioned. Now, the simple truth is that you can find a bit of lead pipe almost anywhere if you look hard enough, and I'd found one pretty quick after my arrival on the island. I kept it hidden inside my mattress, figuring the day would eventually come when one of either the boys or the guards might force me to use it, and the particular bull that finally did would be forever sorry for it. While he was busy trying to hold me down and undo his pants, I laid hold of my pipe, and inside of 2 minutes he had 3 fractures in one arm, 2 in the other, a busted ankle, and a mass of bone chips where his nose used to be. I was still going at him to the encouraging shrieks of the other boys when a couple more guards finally pulled me off. The superintendent of the place asked for a hearing to decide whether or not I should be transferred to an insane asylum, and word of the incident got out to the press. Dr. Kreitzler caught wind of it and showed up at the hearing, once again demanding that no sentence be pronounced without a proper psychological assessment being done first. The judge this time around was a lot more reasonable, and the doctor got his way. For 2 days, he and I sat in an office on the island, doing little more than talking, and for most of the first day, we didn't even talk about the specific facts of my case. He asked me questions about my childhood and, even more important, told me a lot about his, which went a long way toward easing my discomfort at being in the presence of a man what I was grateful to, but who nonetheless filled me with a kind of nervous awe. During those first hours, in fact, I learned many grim facts about the doctor's life that almost nobody knew or knows, and I can see now that he was using his own past as a way to coax mine out of me. It was peculiar. As we talked, I began to comprehend, to the extent that an uneducated young boy could, that I might not just be doing things at random, that maybe I decided on a life of crime and mayhem as much out of anger as out of necessity. This wasn't an idea that the doctor planted in me. He let me come to it myself by showing sympathy for all I'd been through, and even a kind of admiration for my attitude. In fact, he seemed to find the fact that I'd survived what I had and was doing what I was doing not only remarkable, but in a way amusing. And I quickly got the feeling that I was providing him with something more than statistics. The man was enjoying himself. That was the real secret of his success with kids. It wasn't charity work to him. It wasn't the kind of wooden nickel generosity you'd get from mission types. What made troubled children, rich and poor, trust the doctor so much was the fact that he was getting something out of helping them. He loved it all, really loved spending time and effort on his young charges in a way that was at least partly selfish. It was like they made the miserable parts of the adult world what he inhabited so much of the time, the prisons, madhouses, hospitals, and courtrooms, easier to take. Gave him hope for the future on the one hand, and pure and simple amusement on the other. And when you're a kid, you look for that, for the kind of adult who isn't giving you a hand just to get in good with Jesus Christ, but is doing it because he enjoys it. Everybody's got an angle, is all I'm saying, and the fact that the doctors were so obvious and uncomplicated made it all the easier to trust him. At my sanity hearing, the doctor used all the things that we talked about to make short work of the idea that I was crazy, backing his claims up with a little theory he'd worked out over the years, one he called context. It was the core idea behind all the rest of his work, and the basic gist of the thing was that a person's actions and motives can never be truly understood until the full circumstances of his or her early years and growing up are brought to bear on the discussion. Straightforward and harmless enough, you might think, but in fact, it was no small job to defend this notion against the charge that it ran counter to traditional American beliefs by providing excuses for criminal behavior. But the doctor always maintained that there was a big difference between an explanation and an excuse, and that what he was trying to do was understand people's behavior, not make life easier for criminals. Luckily for me, on that particular day his statements found a receptive audience. The members of the hearing board bought the doctor's analysis of my life and behavior, but when he went on to propose that I be enrolled at his institute, they balked, apparently still feeling that so notorious a young hellion as the Stevepipe needed to go someplace where he'd be kept on a shorter leash. They asked Dr. Kreitzler if he had any other ideas. He thought about the matter for some 2 minutes, never looking at me, and then announced that he'd be willing to take me into his employ and his home and assume personal responsibility for my actions. The members of the board grew a little wide-eyed at that, and one of them asked the doctor if he was serious. He told them that he was, and after some more consultation, the deal was set. For the first time, I felt a little unsure. Not because I'd seen anything in the doctor to distrust, but because the 2 days I'd spent with him had set me to thinking about myself and wondering if I'd ever really be able to change my ways. These doubts nagged at me as I cleared my few belongings out of my cell and headed off through the grim old courtyard of the House of Refuge to meet the doctor at his carriage. He had his burgundy barouche out that day. My confusion wasn't eased by the sight of an enormous black man sitting in the barouche's driver's seat. But the man had a kindly face, and as the doctor stepped out of the carriage, he smiled and held a hand up toward his companion. "Stevie," he said, "this is Cyrus Montrose. It may interest you to know that he was on his way to the penitentiary, and a fate far worse than yours might have been before we crossed paths and he came to work for me." I later learned that Cyrus had, as a younger man, killed a crooked Irish cop who'd been beating the life out of a young colored whore in a brothel where Cyrus played piano. Cyrus's parents had been killed by an Irish mob during the draft riots of '63, and at his trial, the doctor had successfully argued that, such being the context of his life, Cyrus had been mentally incapable of any other reaction to the situation in the brothel. I nodded at the big man, who tipped his bowler and gave me a warm look in return. "So," I said uncertainly, "am I gonna work for you too? Is that the deal?"
"Oh, yes, you'll work," the doctor answered. "But you'll study as well. You will read. You'll learn mathematics. You'll investigate history, among many other things."
"I will," I said, swallowing hard. After all, I'd never spent a day in school in my life.
"You will,"
the doctor answered, taking a silver cigarette case out, removing a stick, and lighting it. He looked up to see me staring hungrily at the cigarettes.
"Ah, but I'm afraid that stops. No smoking for you, young man. And this," he went on, stepping over and examining the little pile of things I was carrying, "will no longer be necessary."
He pulled my piece of lead pipe out of some clothes and threw it away onto a patch of thin, ratty-looking grass. It was looking like I was going to be left with nothing but studies, and that fact was not causing me to be any less edgy.
"Well, what about the work?" I finally said. "What'll I do?" "You mentioned," the doctor said, climbing back into the barouche, "that when your activities with Crazy Butch involved waylaying delivery trucks, you were generally assigned to drive them. Was there any particular reason for this?"
I shrugged. "I like horses, and I took to the driving pretty good."
"Then say hello to Frederick and Gwendolyn," the doctor replied, indicating with his cigarette the gelding and mare, what stood in front of the barouche. "And take the reins."
My spirits picked up considerably at that. I went over, patted the handsome black gelding's long snout, ran a hand along the brown mare's neck, and grinned.
"Seriously?" I asked. "You seem to find the idea of work more comforting than that of study," the doctor replied. "So let us see how you manage. Cyrus, you may as well come down and help me with this appointment schedule. I'm a bit lost. It seems from my notes that I was scheduled to be at the Essex Street Courthouse 2 hours ago."
As the big black man got down from the driver's seat, the doctor glanced up at me once more.
"Well, you have a job to do, don't you?"
I gave him another grin and a quick nod, then jumped up into the driver's seat and cracked the reins against the horse's haunches. And I never, as they say, looked back. Yes, they were fine days, those, when we'd never heard the name John Beecham, and Mary Palmer was still alive. Fine days whose return, I realized, we now had good cause to doubt. Those people that had always fought the doctor in his theory of context, and were driven, it seemed to me, by fear of the way his investigations into violent and illegal behavior led him to poke around in the area of how Americans raise their kids, had generally countered his arguments by saying that the United States had been built on the idea that every man is free to choose and is responsible for his individual ideas and actions, no matter what the circumstances of his early life may have been. The doctor didn't really disagree with them on a legal level. He was just looking for deeper scientific answers. And so, for many years, there'd been a kind of stalemate in the battle between the controversial alienist and them what he unnerved so badly. When little Paulie McPherson had hung himself, though, it had given the doctor's enemies a chance to break that stalemate, and they'd grabbed at it. But the judge who'd presided over the first hearing on the matter had been a fair-minded man, and he didn't just flat-out shut the doctor down. Instead, he ordered the 60-day investigation period I've already mentioned, making the kids at the Institute wards of the court for that time, and putting the place in the temporary charge of one Reverend Charles Bancroft, a retired orphanage superintendent. The doctor himself was forbidden to set foot inside the Institute during that time. For a man of his antsy temperament, 60 days, with no sure knowledge of what would come after, could be a genuine eternity. And the question of how hard he'd take leaving the Institute didn't involve just him, either. The kids themselves would play a crucial part, for if even one of them snapped while he was gone, and some of those kids were wound pretty tight, the doctor would, I knew, take all the blame onto himself. He'd always taught his charges to draw strength from the fact that at least one person believed in them and to be ready to use that strength in future times of trouble. But would they be able to do it when the stakes were so high and the outcome was so uncertain? The sudden thunder of a gunshot bellowed out of an alleyway just after I turned onto Forsyth Street, causing Frederick to rear in fright and me to stop daydreaming and jerk my head around to locate the source of the trouble. It had come from back by an old rear tenement building, the closest thing to hell that any living person ever called home. I jumped off the calash to calm Frederick down by stroking his powerful neck and feeding him a couple of cubes of sugar what I always kept in my pocket when I was driving. Keeping my eyes locked on the alleyway, I soon saw the agent of the mayhem, a crazed-looking man, small and wiry, with a big drooping mustache and a slouch hat. He came wandering out of the alley carrying an old side-by-side shotgun, brazen as can be, with no apparent thought to who might be watching. A scream followed him out, but his only answer was to declare, without turning around, "Now I'll take care of your fucking little boyfriend." He then disappeared at the same quick pace around the corner of Eldridge Street. There wasn't a cop to be seen, of course. There rarely was in that part of town, and if one had been around, the sound of the gunshot would in all likelihood have sent him scurrying in the opposite direction. I got back onto the driver's seat of the calash and made for the Institute at a quick pace. Reaching numbers 185 to 187 East Broadway, the two red brick buildings with black trim, what the doctor had bought and converted into one space many years back, I found that there was a young patrolman stationed at the foot of the steps to the main entrance. Jumping to the ground, I gave Frederick a few more pats on the neck and another lump of sugar, then approached the cop, who was too green to know me by sight. "I don't suppose you'd be interested to know that there's a mug wandering up Eldridge Street with a shotgun," I said. "You don't say," the cop answered, looking me over. "And what business might that be of yours?" "None of mine," I said with a shrug. "Just thought it might be some of yours." "My business is right here," the cop announced, straightening his light summer cap and puffing himself up so that his blue tunic looked near to busting. "Court business." "Uh-huh," I said. "Well, maybe you could tell Dr. Kreitzler that his driver's here, seeing as getting him off the premises seems to be the main point of the court's business." The cop turned toward the steps, giving me a glare. "You know," he said as he went up to the door, "an attitude like that could get you in some tight spots, sonny." I let him get inside before shaking my head and spitting into the gutter. "Go chase yourself," I mumbled. "Sonny." Maybe I ought to note here that one of the things all my years with Dr. Kreitzler never did affect, besides my taste for smokes, was my attitude toward cops. In a few minutes, the patrolman reappeared, followed by Dr. Kreitzler, a small group of his students, and a pious-looking old bag of bones, what I took to be the Reverend Bancroft. The kids, some of the doctor's younger charges, were pretty typical of the range of types he generally had at the place. One was a little girl who came from a rich family uptown and who'd refused throughout her life to speak a word to anybody but her nanny until she met Dr. Chrysler, that is. Another was a boy whose folks owned a grocery business in Greenwich Village, a kid who'd taken more than his fair share of beatings for no greater reason than that his conception had been an accident and neither of his parents could stand having him around. Then there was another girl who'd been found by a friend of the doctor's working in an adult disorderly house, even though she wasn't but 10 years old. Just how the man happened to find her in said disorderly house, the doctor never inquired too closely about. Another was a boy who hailed from a big manor house in Rhode Island and who'd passed most of his 8 years breaking everything he could lay his hands on in a string of unending tantrums. They were all dressed in the Institute's gray and blue uniforms, which the doctor had designed himself and required the kids to wear so that the richer ones couldn't lord it over the poor. The first little girl, the one who had never spoken to her family, had a firm grip on one of the doctor's legs, making it tough for him to move as he walked alongside the reverend and gave him some last bits of instruction and advice. The other girl was holding both her hands behind her back and looking around like she wasn't quite sure what the hell was going on. The two boys, meantime, were laughing and taking playful jabs at each other from opposite sides of the doctor, using him as a shield. All in all, a pretty typical scene for the place. But if you looked close, there were clues that something unusual was up. Chief among these was the doctor himself. His black linen suit was rumpled and wrinkled in spots, making it pretty clear that he'd been up working all night. Even if the clothes hadn't given him away, his face would have. It was drawn and exhausted, and the look of contentment, what could be found in his features only at the Institute, was nowhere to be seen. As he spoke to Reverend Bancroft, he leaned forward with a kind of uncertainty that was unusual for him, and the Reverend seemed to sense it. He put his hand on the doctor's back and told him to just relax and try to make the best use of the weeks to come, that he was sure everything would work out for the best. At that point, the doctor stopped talking and just shook his head in resignation, rubbing his black eyes and suddenly becoming conscious of the kids what were all around and over him. He smiled and tried to perk up as he first pried the one little girl off his leg and then got the two boys to calm down, speaking to them like he did to all us kids, with affection but directly, as if there was no wall of age between them. When he looked up and caught sight of me at the curb, I could see that he was trying to hold himself together long enough to make it to the calash, but the second little girl proceeded to make that job a lot tougher. Out from behind her back, she brought a bunch of roses, wrapped in the plain paper of a local flower shop, but still showing the full glory of the new summer in their white and pink petals. The doctor smiled and kneeled down to take them from her, though when she threw her arms around his neck, that former fallen angel, what the doctor had given a second lease on childhood, his smile disappeared, and it was all he could do to keep his composure. He stood up quickly, told the boys one more time to behave themselves, then shook hands with Reverend Bancroft and near ran down the steps. I had the carriage door open, and he shot in. "Get me home, Stevie," was all he managed to say, and like spit I was back on top, whip in hand. The kids continued to wave as I turned the calash around and headed back the way I'd come. But Dr. Chrysler made no reply, just sank further into the maroon leather seat of the carriage. He remained silent during the trip uptown, even when I mentioned my near run-in with the shotgun-toting maniac. I glanced back just a few times, the first to see if he was even awake. He was. But though the morning was only growing more beautiful, with the breeze continuing to blow the smells of fresh, full greenery and leaves around the street so that they near overcame the stench of garbage piles and horse manure and urine, he didn't seem to take note of it. He had his right hand balled into a fist that he tapped against his mouth as he stared intensely at nothing, and with his left hand he clutched at the bunch of roses so tight that one of the thorns stabbed him. I heard him hiss a little in pain, but I didn't say anything. I didn't know what I could say. The man was a spent bullet, that much was clear, and the best thing for me to do was get him home in a hurry. With that in mind, I gave Frederick a little ripple of the reins and told him to pick up his pace, and soon we were moving back around Stuyvesant Park. Once inside the house at 17th Street, the doctor, his face by now ashen with exhaustion, turned to Cyrus and me. "I've got to try to get some rest," he mumbled, starting up the stairs. He stopped and flinched a bit at the sound of a bucket overturning in the kitchen hallway with what was, even from Mrs. Leshko, an amazing crash. The racket was followed by a long stream of what I figured were Russian curses. The doctor sighed. "Assuming it's possible to communicate with that woman, would you please ask her to keep the house quiet for a few hours? If she's incapable, give her the afternoon off."
"Yes, sir, doctor," Cyrus said. "If you need anything..."
The doctor only held up a hand and nodded in acknowledgement, then disappeared up the stairs. Cyrus and I looked at each other.
"Well,"
Cyrus whispered to me. "It isn't good," I answered, "but I've got an idea." Another crash and more curses came from the kitchen. "You handle Mrs. Leshko," I said. "I'm going to telephone to Mr. Moore." Cyrus nodded, and then I bolted down through the kitchen hallway and past the muttering, mopping mass of blue linen and stout flesh that was Mrs. Leshko. I kept on going through the white ceramic tiling and hanging pots and pans of the kitchen itself, and finally got into the pantry where there was a telephone on the wall. Closing the pantry door, I grabbed the phone's small receiver, yanked the stem of the mouthpiece down to my height, and got hold of an operator telling her to connect me to the New York Times. In a few seconds, I had Mr. Moore on the other end. "Stevie," he said, "we've had some developments, interesting ones." "Yeah? Any word on the baby?" "Only confirmation that she is, in fact, missing. None of the help at the consulate have seen her in days. I didn't want to question anybody higher up, though, not with what the Senora's been through. But tell me, what's the word on your end?"
"Well, he's in pretty bad shape right now," I answered. "But he's gone up to rest, and I think..."
Mr. Moore paused, waiting for me to go on, and I could hear the clack of typewriters in the background.
"You think?"
"I don't know. This case, if you were to put it to him just the right way, he might. I mean, the whole connection to the Spanish business, and the Senora, if we could get him to meet her, and that picture of the little girl."
"What are you saying, Stevie?"
"Only that he's in a mood, all right, and if this case leads in the direction it might..."
"Ah," Mr. Moore noised in a happier tone. "I see. Well, your education's starting to pay off, kid."
"It is?"
"If I get you right, you're saying that this case may end up revealing some pretty unattractive things about the same kind of society types that are trying to shut the doctor down. And the fact that it involves an innocent baby is just so much gravy, right?"
"Well, yeah, something like that."
Mr. Moore whistled. "I'll tell you what, Stevie. I've known Laszlo since we were younger than you are. I don't care how fed up and exhausted he is. If that doesn't get him going, we can start planning his funeral now, because he's already dead."
"Yeah, but we gotta slip the idea to him right."
"Don't you worry about that. I've already figured it out. Tell the doctor the rest of us are coming by for cocktails." I heard a voice call to Mr. Moore in the background. "Yeah?" he answered, away from the mouthpiece.
"What? Bensonhurst? No, Harry, I cover New York. I don't care what Boss Platt says. Bensonhurst is not New York."
"But it wasn't my story to start with."
"Oh, all right.
His voice grew more distinct in my ear. "Got to go, Stevie. Some fool doctor tried to shoot his family in Bensonhurst last night. Apparently, the authorities don't like the way we reported the story. Listen, don't forget, we'll be by for cocktails."
"But you haven't told me about the other developments."
"Later," he answered. The line clicked dead, leaving me with no choice but to wait until that evening to find out what in the world Mr. Moore could have been talking about. Chapter 7. Dr. Kreisler managed to sleep until mid-afternoon, after which he called Cyrus into his study. I popped my head in, too, to let the doctor know that Mr. Moore, Miss Howard, and the Isaacsons intended on coming by for cocktails, a prospect what seemed to give him some consolation. Then he and Cyrus started to sort through all the mail the doctor hadn't attended to in recent days. While they were closeted away with this work, I tried to get a few hours of study in, though my effort wasn't exactly wholehearted, excusing myself with the thought that most kids weren't required to do schoolwork in the summertime. I headed down to the carriage house to have a secret smoke and give Frederick some more oats and another brush down. Then it was Gwendolyn's turn, which she waited for with her usual patience. She was a good horse, as strong as Frederick, but without his spunk,
and spending time with her helped to ease some of my anxiousness. Our guests showed up at near 6:30. The sun was still bright behind the two square, squat towers of St. George's Church on the west side of Stuyvesant Park, what with it being the longest day of the year, and all the reports said that the weather would hold through most of the week. Mr. Moore and the others trotted up the stairs to the parlor, where the doctor was reading a letter and listening to Cyrus play and sing a sad, lonely operatic number that most likely had something to do with people falling in love and then dying, such being the general concern of operas, from what little I've ever been able to make out about that particular musical form. I watched the scene that followed, as was my habit, from a shadowy corner at the top of the next flight of stairs. The doctor rose and shook each person's hand warmly, while Mr. Moore smacked a palm against the doctor's back. "Laszlo, you look like hell," he announced, immediately making for a silver box of cigarettes that contained a nice blend of Virginia and Russian black tobaccos. "It's good of you to notice, Moore," the doctor answered with a sigh, indicating the easy chair across from his to Miss Howard. "Sarah, please." "As ever, John is the soul of tact," Miss Howard said as she sat down. "All things considered, Doctor, I think you look remarkably well."
Yes," the doctor noised doubtfully, "all things considered."
Miss Howard smiled again as she realized how backhanded her compliment had been, but the doctor smiled back, letting her off the hook and telling her he appreciated the thought.
"And the detective sergeants are here as well," he went on. "This is indeed a welcome surprise. I've had a letter from Roosevelt today. I've just been reading it."
"Really?" Lucius said, moving closer to the doctor's chair with his brother. "What's he say?"
"I bet he's not terrorizing the sailors the way he did our beat cops," Marcus added. "I hate to interrupt," Mr. Moore said from across the room, "but we did come for cocktails. Are we free to fix them ourselves, Kreitzler?"
He indicated a nearby glass and mahogany cart, what was loaded down with bottles.
"I trust that battle axe downstairs isn't going to do it. What is she, anyway, some kind of refugee or something?"
"Mrs. Lesko?"
As he spoke, the doctor nodded toward the liquor cart, and Mr. Moore ran for it like a dying man in the desert.
"No, I fear she actually is our current housekeeper, and, to my everlasting regret, our cook. I have Cyrus trying to find her another position. I'd rather not let her go before she has something else."
"You don't mean to say you actually eat her food?"
Mr. Moore said, setting out six glasses and filling each of them with gin, a little vermouth and a dash of bitters. Martinis, he called them, though I've heard bartenders label the drink a martinez, too.
"Laszlo, you know what Russian cuisine is like," he went on, handing the drinks around. "I mean, they only eat it over there because they have to."
"I'm painfully aware of that, Moore, believe me."
"What about the letter, Doctor?" Miss Howard asked as she sipped her drink. "What does our esteemed assistant secretary have to say?"
"Nothing good, I'm afraid," the doctor answered. "When I last heard from Roosevelt, he told me that he and Cabot Lodge had been spending rather a lot of time at Henry Adams's house. Henry himself is in Europe at the moment, but that absurd brother of his seems to be holding court in his dining room while he's away."
"Brooks?" Miss Howard said. "You find that troubling, Doctor?"
"Surely you don't think anyone actually listens to him," Marcus added. "I'm not entirely certain," the doctor replied. "I wrote to Roosevelt to tell him that I consider Brooks Adams to be delusional, perhaps pathologically. In this letter he says that he's inclined to agree with me, but that he still finds merit in many of the man's ideas."
Lucius's eyes went round. "That's a frightening thought, all that talk about martial spirit and warlike blood."
"Contemptible nonsense, that's what it is," the doctor pronounced. "When men like Brooks Adams call for a war to reinvigorate our countrymen, they only reveal their own degeneracy. Why, if that fellow ever found himself near a battlefield—"
"Laszlo," Mr. Moore said, "relax. Brooks is the fashion of the moment, that's all. Nobody takes him seriously."
"No, but men like Roosevelt and Lodge are taking his ideas seriously."
The doctor stood and walked over to stand next to a large potted palm by one of the open French windows, shaking his head all the while.
"They're down there in Washington now, scheming like schoolboys to get us into a war with Spain. And I tell you all, such a war will change this country, profoundly, and not for the better."
Mr. Moore smiled as he drank. You sound like Professor James. He's been saying the same things. You haven't been in touch with him, have you?
Don't be ridiculous, the doctor said, slightly embarrassed at the mention of his old teacher, who, in fact, he hadn't spoken to for many years.
Well, Lucius said, trying to be even-handed, the Spaniards do have some reason to be resentful. We've called them everything from swine to butchers for their treatment of the Cuban rebels.
Miss Howard displayed a puzzled smile. How is it that a person can be a swine and a butcher?
I don't know, but they've managed it, Mr. Moore answered. They've acted like sadistic savages, trying to suppress the rebellion, concentration camps, mass executions.
Yes, but the rebels have been vicious in return, John, Marcus countered. Captured soldiers massacred? Civilians, too, if they won't support the cause.
Marcus is right, Moore, the doctor threw in impatiently. This rebellion is not about freedom or democracy. It's about power. One side has it, the other side wants it. That's all.
True, Mr. Moore conceded with a shrug.
And we appear to want some sort of an American empire, Lucius added.
Yes, God help us.
The doctor wandered back over to his chair, then picked up the letter from Mr. Roosevelt and scanned it one more time. Folding it up as he sat back down, he put the thing aside with another noise of disgust.
But enough of that. He rubbed a hand over his face. All right, then, suppose you all tell me what brings you here.
What brings us? Mr. Moore made a show of innocence and shock that would have done any Bowery variety star proud.
Why, what should bring us?
Concern, moral support, all of that.
Only that? The doctor asked suspiciously.
No, not only that.
Mr. Moore turned to the piano for a moment.
Cyrus, do you think we could have something a little less funereal? I'm sure we're all sorry that old Otello mistakenly strangled his lovely wife, but given the display nature's putting on outside, I think we might forego such sentiments. You wouldn't happen to know anything less, well, stuffy, would you? After all, friends and colleagues, it's summer.
Cyrus answered by gently breaking into White, a popular song from the 40s, what seemed to set Mr. Moore right up. He beamed a big grin at the doctor, who only looked at him with some concern.
There really are moments, the doctor said, when I doubt your sanity, Moore.
Oh, come on, Kreitzler, Mr. Moore answered. I'm telling you, everything's going to be fine. In fact, we've brought you living proof that things are starting to go your way.
Mr. Moore indicated Marcus and Lucius with a little nod of his head.
The detective sergeants?
The doctor said quietly, looking to them.
But what can you have to do with any of this?
Marcus glanced at Mr. Moore with some annoyance, then handed him his empty glass.
That was truly graceful, John, he said. Suppose you stick to bartending.
My pleasure, said Mr. Moore, dancing back over to the cocktail cart.
The doctor gave up on expecting sense from his journalistic friend and turned to the Isaacsons again.
Gentlemen, have Moore's nerves given way altogether, causing him to bring you here for some imaginary reason?
Oh, it wasn't John, Marcus answered quickly.
You can thank Captain O'Brien, Lucius added, if thank is the right word.
The head of the detective bureau?
Dr. Kreitzler said. And what can I thank him for?
The fact that you'll be seeing quite a bit of us in the next 60 days, I'm afraid, Marcus replied. You're aware, Doctor, that the court ordered a police investigation of affairs at your clinic?
What was coming next clicked in my head right then, as I'm sure it did in the doctor's. Nevertheless, he said only,
yes?
Well, Lucius continued for his brother, we're it, I'm afraid.
What?
They were both shock and relief in the doctor's voice.
You too?
But doesn't O'Brien know that we're friends of yours? Marcus said.
Indeed he does. That was part of the amusement for him, you see.
Now how do we begin this?
As the detective sergeant's explanation of what had gone on earlier that day at police headquarters was peppered with their usual squabbling over who'd been responsible for what, I may as well boil the tale down myself. It had started with the piece of a body that Cyrus and I had seen on the waterfront by the Cunard Pier the night before.
Well, really, it had started when the Isaacsons joined the force in the first place, for their advanced methods and peculiar attitudes, linked with the fact that they were Jewish, had made them instantly and almost universally disliked. But so far as this incident in particular was concerned, it was the body that had set it off. It had been obvious to everyone, from the patrolmen on the scene to Captain Hogan and then up to Captain O'Brien of the Detective Bureau, that the section of torso was likely to develop into quite a sensational case. Summer in New York is just not complete without a big, splashy murder mystery, and this one had all the earmarks, starting with the probability that more pieces of the body would soon start to wash up in other parts of town, which they did. There'd already been and would likely continue to be a lot of press coverage of the thing, and great attention paid to whoever worked on and solved it. But the deal had to be played just right. The cops had to represent it to the public as something what'd be tougher than shoe leather to work out, so that they could cover themselves with laurels when the time came. The Isaacsons had been dispatched to the scene in the middle of the night, when Captain O'Brien was asleep and nobody knew what was waiting down at the pier. Otherwise, they never would have gotten so close in the first place. O'Brien would choke before he gave what looked to be the summer's biggest catch to a pair of detectives who spent near all their time telling him that his methods were so out of date as to be laughable. But the Isaacsons had really finished any chance what they might have had of working on the thing by writing up an initial report along the lines of what we'd heard Lucius saying that night by the river. All indications were that it was a crime of passion committed by someone close to the victim, someone who knew his identifying marks and had carefully cut them away. Someone, in other words, whose main concern was hiding the victim's identity and throwing suspicion off of themselves. But for the brass at the Detective Bureau, such wasn't good enough. They preferred the idea of a crazed anatomist or medical student dealing in body parts, the kind of spooky tale that always sparks the public's imagination. And that's just what they started to give out to the papers that very night. The fact that everything about the body spoke directly against such an idea, well, that kind of thing never bothered the Detective Bureau much. A real solution to a crime never rated against an invented story that could be used to their advantage. Anyway, when Monday morning rolled around, Captain O'Brien saw the Isaacsons' initial report and decided that if he was going to milk the mystery of the headless body for all it was worth, he'd have to keep the brothers as far away from it as possible. It so happened that he also needed to make an assignment that morning of two detectives to investigate conditions at the Kreitzler Institute for Children and the apparent suicide of young Paulie McPherson. And he took no wee bit of fiendish Irish pleasure in informing the Isaacsons that not only were they off the torso case, they were on the McPherson business. He knew that they were acquaintances of Dr. Kreitzler's, but like most cops, O'Brien had no liking for the doctor and would only be tickled by making the situation even more difficult for him than it already was. If the thing turned out bad, and the Isaacsons had to come down on their friend, well, that would just be a bigger laugh. And if nothing came of it, O'Brien would at least have succeeded in keeping the brothers out of the more important headless body business. "And so," Marcus finished up, "here we are. I'm sorry, Doctor. We'll try to make it as convenient and, well, dignified for you as we can." "Indeed we will," Lucius tacked on anxiously. The doctor moved in quickly to put them at their ease. "Don't let yourselves feel odd about it. Either of you. There was nothing you could have done. Such a move was to be expected, really. We must try to make the most of it." His voice became touched by sadness for a moment. "I've racked my own mind, and those of my staff, for any clue as to what drove the McPherson boy to take his own life. Without success, I'm afraid. I'm as certain as I can be that there was no incident at the Institute to spark it, though you must, of course, decide all that for yourselves. I do hope you know, however, that there are no two people in the world I would sooner trust with the matter than yourselves."
"Thank you, sir," Lucius mumbled.
"Yes," Marcus said, "though I'm afraid we'll be a damned nuisance to you."
"Nonsense," Dr. Kreitzler added, and I could hear in his voice that the relief he felt over things working out this way was growing into a kind of happiness. I glanced at Mr. Moore and Miss Howard, and found them smiling in a fashion what said they were positively delighted things had worked out this way, and it was no big job to figure out why. While the Isaacsons' new assignment would only increase the chances of the doctor taking on the Linares case, it would also cinch it that we'd have the talents of the detective sergeants on tap 24 hours a day. Such was cause for smiles, indeed.
"It's all a lot of noise over nothing, anyway," Mr. Moore said as he handed a second round of drinks to everyone. "The word at the Times is that this whole affair is going to blow over."
"Is it?" the doctor mumbled, not too reassured.
"Absolutely."
As Mr. Moore reached the doctor's chair, I noticed that he bent over somewhat suddenly to hand the doctor his cocktail, and as he did, a packet of papers and letters came flying out of the inside pocket of his jacket.
"Oh, damn it," Mr. Moore said in a voice that might have sounded completely genuine if I hadn't known that the larger purpose of the evening was to get the doctor to sign on for the Linares case. "Laszlo," he went on, indicating the papers and handing a drink to Lucius, "would you mind?"
The doctor reached to the floor and picked up the scattered documents, giving them a quick once-over as he arranged them back into a pile. He suddenly stopped when he reached something. It was the photograph of little Anna Linares. As I'm sure the cagey Mr. Moore knew he would, the doctor paused to study the thing, and as he did, he began to smile.
"What a charming child," he said quietly. "The daughter of a friend, John?"
"Hmm?" Mr. Moore noised, all innocence.
"Well, she's entirely too beautiful to be a relation," the doctor went on, to which the others laughed a little. Their first mistake, for the doctor had not shown the picture to any of them. If they knew the smiling, pretty face it displayed, then something was up. The doctor glanced at them all carefully. "Such being the case," he said quietly, continuing to address Mr. Moore, "who is she?"
"Oh," Mr. Moore answered, retrieving the packet of letters and folded documents, "it's nothing, Laszlo, forget it." As this little dance continued, I saw Detective Sergeant Lucius pick up the evening edition of the Times and plaster it over his face nervously, though it was obvious he wasn't reading a word. The doctor leaned toward Mr. Moore.
"What do you mean it's nothing? Have you taken to carrying pictures of anonymous children?"
"No, but it's... well, it's nothing you should worry about."
"I'm not worried," the doctor protested. "Why should I be worried?"
"That's right," Mr. Moore said. "No reason." The doctor eyed him.
"Is it something you're worried about?"
Mr. Moore sipped his drink and held up a hand. "Laszlo, please, you've got enough on your mind. Let's just skip it."
"John," the doctor answered, standing and speaking with genuine concern now, "if you're in some kind of trouble..."
He stopped as Miss Howard reached up to touch his arm. "You needn't press, John, doctor," Miss Howard said. "The fact is, it's a little matter I'm looking into. He's been giving me some help, that's all. I lent him the photograph."
Leaning back and turning to Miss Howard, the doctor grew less concerned and more intrigued. "Ah, a case, Sarah?"
"Yes,"
was her simple answer.
I could see that the doctor was continuing to make much of his friend's holding back, and his next remark was a bit more pointed.
"Detective Sergeant," he said to the ever-nervous Lucius, "I believe you'll have more success reading that paper if you turn it right side up."
"Oh," Lucius answered, fixing the problem with a rustle of newsprint as Marcus let out a little sigh. "Yes, I suppose you're right, doctor."
There was another moment of silence, after which the doctor spoke again. "I take it you, too, are also giving Miss Howard some help with her case?"
"Oh, not really," Marcus answered uneasily. "Not much, that is. Still, the thing is interesting, in a way."
"Actually, doctor," Miss Howard said, "we could use your thoughts on it. Informally, I mean. If it wouldn't be any imposition, that is."
"Of course,"
the doctor replied, and the way he said it, it seemed to me that he was beginning to form an idea of what was going on and might be agreeing to take the first few steps down the road toward getting involved. Sensing that they'd gotten the hook in, Mr. Moore brightened and looked at his watch.
"Well, we'd better discuss all this at dinner. I've got a table at Mookins, Chrysler, and you're coming along."
"Well, I..." Ordinarily, in recent days, the doctor would have found a way to bow out of this social engagement, but that night he was too intrigued to even try.
"I would be happy to."
"Right," Mr. Moore said, "and Cyrus will be happy to drive, won't you, Cyrus?"
"Yes, sir," Cyrus replied cheerfully.
Mr. Moore turned to the staircase.
"Stevie?"
"On my way,"
I answered, bounding down.
"The barouche, if you please," Mr. Moore told me. "Cyrus, get the doctor ready for a night on the town, will you?"
Cyrus nodded as I ran downstairs and out the front door to get Gwendolyn and Frederick harnessed and hitched up to the barouche. By the time I drew the carriage up to the front gate, the others were coming out of the house. I turned the reins over to Cyrus, and as the rest of them climbed in, the doctor reminded me to make good use of the evening and get to bed early. As they drove off, I could only laugh at that idea.
Chapter 8. Anticipation, of the kind that had eaten me up all afternoon, set back to work on the insides that evening. I went down to the kitchen and told Mrs. Leshko that she could go home early, as I'd see to the glasses and such in the parlor. She gave me a big grin and near wrenched my cheeks off in gratitude, then got her things together and departed. I went up to the parlor and straightened up the cocktail wagon, taking the glasses downstairs to wash them. Then it was upstairs for several hours of the history of ancient Rome and half a packet of cigarettes, all of which was interrupted by the occasional trip to our new icebox for something to nibble on, periodic bouts of nervous pacing, and long minutes of wondering whether or not the doctor would agree to help find little Anna Linares. After dropping the others off at their respective homes, the doctor returned to 17th Street at about midnight. Such was early by the group's usual standards, but in recent weeks the doctor hadn't allowed himself anything like so much leisure, so I took the time of his return as a good sign. He entered the house alone, Cyrus was next door tending to the horses, and as I heard him come in, I started down for the parlor where I knew he'd be pouring himself a nightcap. I'd taken the precaution of getting into some night clothes and a robe, and as I walked slowly down the stairs, I ran my hands through my hair once or twice to muss it up. Then I did my best to look sleepy, giving out with a quiet yawn as I entered the parlor and found the doctor sitting in his chair with a small glass of cognac, once again going over his letter from Mr. Roosevelt. He looked up when I came in.
"Stevie, what are you doing up? It's late."
"Only midnight," I answered, walking over to the window. "Must have dozed off, though." The doctor let out a small laugh.
"An excellent attempt, Stevie, but a trifle transparent."
I didn't say anything, just kind of chuckled and shrugged. Setting his glass aside, the doctor walked over to stand at the other window. After a moment, he quietly said,
"You realize, Stevie, what they want me to do?"
The question might seem to have come out of nowhere, but I guess I was expecting something like it, being as I answered without much hesitation, "Uh-huh, pretty much."
"And how long have you known?"
"Miss Howard told us about it last night." The doctor nodded, smiling for just a second, then kept staring out the window.
"I'm not sure that I can."
I shrugged again. "It's your decision, I guess. I mean, I do understand with what happened."
"Yes."
He didn't turn as he added,
"We almost lost you last time around."
That was a surprise. I'd been so convinced that Mary Palmer would be foremost in his thoughts when it came to considering the Linares case that I'd clear forgotten that I'd had a pretty close brush with the Reaper during the same attack that had left her dead. And so had Cyrus, a fact what I quickly reminded the doctor of.
"Cyrus is a grown man," he answered. "If he tells me he is willing to take the risks involved with this case, then that is his decision. God knows the Beecham affair should have given him a point of reference."
He paused, then took in a very deep, tired breath and let it out in a slow hiss.
"But you are a different case."
I pondered the thing. I never thought, I mean, I figured you'd be thinking of...
I know, the doctor answered. It wouldn't have been like you to think anything else. You haven't had many years of believing that you're important, Stevie, but you are. Mary was, too. I don't have to tell you that, but she's gone now. It was as much as he could bear to say about her, and more than he ever had to me.
Still doesn't seem natural, I said, letting the words out before I had had time to think. Not having her around?
No. And it never will.
The doctor pulled out his watch and began to fiddle with it in a way that was strange for him, like he wasn't sure just how to say what was on his mind.
I do not expect to ever have children, Stevie. Of my own, I mean. But if I were to have a son, I could only wish that he would have your courage, in all ways.
He tucked the watch away.
I can't let my actions put you in danger again.
Yeah, I said, I get that, but... Words were becoming a problem for me, too. But I was in danger my whole life. I mean, before I came to live with you. It ain't that big of a thing, so long as there's some kind of sensible reason for it. In this case, well, you've seen that picture of the little girl, and it's pretty obvious what could be hanging on the thing. I stamped my foot once, lightly, trying to be clear. I wouldn't want to think that I kept you out of it, that's all. The rest of them, they all know they need you. If I'm in the way, you can, I don't know, ship me off someplace. But you ought to help them, because, like Detective Sergeant Lucius said, this thing could get real big and real ugly. The doctor smiled at that and gave me what you might call a scrutinizing look.
And when did he say that?
I laughed a bit, knocking a fist lightly to my forehead. Oh, right, that would have been last night, I guess.
Ah.
For what seemed quite a while, but couldn't actually have been more than a few minutes, not even enough time for Cyrus to finish up in the carriage house, we both just stood there, looking out at Stuyvesant Park. Then the doctor said,
"The detective sergeants found the weapon this morning, did they tell you?"
I spun toward him in excitement. "No! Mr. Moore said there'd been developments, though. What was it, a piece of pipe?"
"Your old trademark," the doctor answered with a nod, pulling out his cigarette case. "It was under one of the benches around the Egyptian obelisk. They dusted for fingerprints and found several. There was also some blood on the thing, though it's impossible to say who or even what it came from. Much work to be done in that area of forensics, I'm afraid."
He lit his cigarette, then blew smoke out the open window with a troubled but fascinated look on his face.
"Who the devil would kidnap the daughter of a high Spanish official and then fail to capitalize on it in some way?"
A smile crept into my face.
"Then you are going to help them?"
The doctor sighed again.
"I have a dilemma, it seems. I wouldn't want you to have to be sent away, Stevie. Yet I can't be the agent of further threats to your safety."
He took another long drag off his cigarette.
"Tell me, what would your solution to such a problem be?"
"Mine?"
"Yes. How do you think I should handle it?"
I groped for words. "You should, well, you should do what you've always done. Just be my friend. Trust that I know how to handle myself, because I do."
I let out a small grunt of a laugh.
"Good as the rest of you, anyway."
The doctor smiled, then walked over to tousle my hair lightly. "True enough, and stated with your usual respect for your elders." Then we heard the front door open and close, after which Cyrus came loping up the stairs. He paused when he saw me in the parlor, as if he thought that the conversation might be private, but the doctor called him in. "You may as well know, too, Cyrus," he said, putting his cigarette out in an ashtray. "We seem to be re-entering the detection business, that is, if you wish."
Cyrus just nodded once.
"Very much, sir." "You'll keep an eye on our young friend here, won't you?" the doctor added. "It seems that he's already been knocking about the city at all hours of the night with the detective sergeants."
The doctor looked up from the ashtray to Cyrus. You wouldn't know anything about that, I suppose.
Cyrus only smiled, crossed his hands, and glanced at the floor.
I might know something about it. Yes, doctor.
I thought you might, the doctor answered, heading for the stairs.
Well, I, for one, intend to get some sleep. It may be in short supply soon.
He paused before heading upstairs and turned to us.
Do be careful, both of you. God knows where this thing will lead.
Cyrus and I mumbled solemn pledges that we'd try to watch ourselves, but when the doctor had disappeared up the stairs and into his bedroom, there was no way on earth we could keep ourselves from smiling.
Chapter 9.
The doctor telephoned Miss Howard, Mr. Moore, and the detective sergeants the next morning to inform them of his decision and to direct Miss Howard to set up a meeting with Senora Linares for that evening at No. 808 Broadway so that he could personally interview her. Miss Howard soon called back, saying she'd been able to schedule an appointment for 8:30. Then the doctor withdrew into his study to begin gathering his thoughts and assembling his research for the job ahead. He issued occasional orders to Cyrus and me, dispatching one or the other of us to various stores and libraries to track down books and journals. This activity nearly kept me from my own urgent mission of the morning, getting bets down for myself and Mr. Moore on the first real-class horse race of the season, the Suburban Handicap at the Coney Island Jockey Club's track in Sheepshead Bay. But I juggled it all fine, and Mr. Moore and I finished the day with some very tidy winnings. At about 7:45 in the evening, the doctor announced that we'd better get ready to go, as he wanted to walk downtown. He claimed that it was on account of the fine weather, but I think he really felt much more nervous about going back to number 808 than he'd expected to. The walk over to Broadway and then downtown did seem to calm him, though, and by the time we'd reached the old headquarters, sunset was beginning, the rich golden color that spread over the rooftops, making it hard to imagine that we were venturing into anything really dangerous. Dr. Kreitzler entered number 808, much as the rest of us had 2 days earlier, slowly, cautiously, letting the memories take full effect before he made any definitive movement or statement. As the elevator carried us up to the 6th floor, silence abounded, though when the doctor saw the sign that Miss Howard had painted on the door, he couldn't help but laugh once quietly and shake his head.
"Sufficiently euphemistic, I should think," he murmured. "Sarah certainly knows her audience."
Then it was inside to find Miss Howard and the Senora once again sitting in two of the easy chairs. Senora Linares wore the same black clothing, and her veil was up, showing that her wounds had healed only a little since the last time we saw her. She seemed very relieved to meet Dr. Kreitzler, and as they spoke, she opened up in a way she hadn't when Mr. Moore and the Isaacsons had examined her. As for the doctor, he stayed intensely focused on the visitor for most of the time, though his occasional quick glances around the room tipped me off to the fact that he was thinking about other things, too. Things that weren't far enough in the past yet to seem really finished. The doctor's examination of the Senora took just over an hour, and involved, of course, questions that to most people would have seemed thoroughly unrelated to the matter at hand. Questions about her family, her childhood, where she'd grown up, how she'd met her husband, why she'd married him. Then there were deeper inquiries about the state of that marriage over the last couple of years. The Senora willingly answered these, even though she was clearly confused about their purpose. I think the doctor would have kept going longer if he could have, being as his subject was so compliant, but when she realized that 9:30 had come and gone, she became very anxious and agitated, saying that she hadn't had time to work out a good cover story for the meeting and needed to get back home in a hurry. Cyrus deposited her in a hansom, returning to the 6th floor just as true darkness descended on the city. During the few minutes he was gone, the doctor started silently wandering around the room, maybe going over what he'd just heard, maybe thinking again about other older matters, maybe doing a bit of both. Whatever the case, nobody even considered interrupting him. Only the sound of the elevator's return finally brought him back out of his deep ponderings. He looked up kind of blankly, then turned to Miss Howard, who'd switched on a small electrical light and was sitting on the edge of its glow.
"Well, Sarah," the doctor said, "what's become of our board?"
Miss Howard smiled wide and fairly ran over to the Japanese screen, laying hold of the big rolling chalkboard and dragging it out to face the desks. It had obviously been recently scrubbed clean. The doctor approached it, staring at its black, empty surface. Then he removed his jacket, picked up a spanking new piece of chalk, cracked it in half, and in quick slashing motions wrote the words, "Possible political explanations," across the top of the board. Shaking the half piece of chalk around inside one closed hand, he turned to the rest of us.
"We begin with the futile, I'm afraid," he announced. "The first task that faces us is to explore any possible political component of this crime. Though I must tell you before we go any further that I do not believe such a component exists."
Mr. Moore automatically slipped behind one of the desks as he asked, "You buy the idea that the child's identity is just a coincidence, Kreitzler?"
"I buy nothing, John, but I believe, as the detective sergeants have suggested, that this is a random act. And I must tell you that if our goal is to return the child to her mother, as I presume it is, then that randomness attains a very grim dimension."
With a single broad stroke, the doctor drew a circle in the center of the board, and then marked stations at its major points as he spoke on.
"As I think even you will see, Moore, any attempt at a political explanation results in something of a logical circle, one that leads nowhere. We start here."
He tapped the 12 o'clock position on the diagram. "The child has been abducted in the manner the Senora says. I don't think there's any question about her telling the truth there. She's a sound, strong person. Her being here alone proves that much. Were she the sort of neurotic woman who craves sympathy and attention—" The doctor suddenly paused, staring out the window.
"And such creatures do exist."
He came back from wherever he'd been.
"Then we would hardly do as an audience, and a fabricated story about a kidnapping accompanied by a thorough beating would hardly be a convenient dramatic vehicle. No. Her history, her position, her mentality, they all point toward the truth. And so, the child has been abducted and the mother struck on the head. By, if we are to accept Moore's political hypothesis, an expert."
"Who chooses a very public spot in broad daylight," Lucius droned doubtfully, opening a little notebook to make a record of the discussion.
"Ah, my dear Detective Sergeant, I share your skepticism," the doctor answered. "But we must not dispose of this theory through mere intuition." He quickly wrote, "An abduction by a professional for political purposes," at the top of the circle. "After all, perhaps the kidnapper was a man of rare pluck and pride who enjoys the challenge of working under unusually dangerous circumstances."
"With a piece of lead pipe," Marcus added, his voice crossing over into open sarcasm.
"With an instrument that he can easily discard, so that it will not be discovered on his person by the police, should he be detained for any reason. After all, our young friend in the windowsill—" the doctor jerked a thumb in my direction— "carried just such a weapon for just such a reason. Isn't that so, Stevie?"
I glanced around to find each of them staring at me.
"Well, yeah, I guess."
They kept staring, and I started to fidget.
"It ain't like I do it any more," I protested, which seemed to give them a chuckle.
"All right, then," the doctor said, taking the limelight back off of me. "He's a professional, who happens to be about the height of his victim and possesses a remarkably light touch."
The doctor moved to the right side of the circle.
"But who can have hired him? Moore, you're the one who favors this interpretation. Give me your candidates."
"We're not short on those," Mr. Moore answered from his desk. "There's a lot of people who'd like to see a diplomatic incident between the United States and Spain right now. We can start with the war party in this country."
"Very well," the doctor said, listing them as U.S. citizens favoring war on the board. "Those Americans who don't care who starts the war so long as we finish it."
"Exactly," Mr. Moore said.
Many frowned, though I doubt they'd want Americans to come off looking quite so brutal.
Who else? The doctor demanded.
Well, there's the Cubans, Mr. Moore replied.
The exiles here in New York, they'd be in favor of anything that started a war, too.
The Cuban Revolutionary Party, Marcus added. They've got an office down on Front Street near the docks on the east side. Moldy old building. They're up on the fourth floor. Lucius and I can rouse them tomorrow, if you like.
I submit that tonight would be more useful, Dr. Kreitzler replied. If they have the child, they are far more likely to plan its fate in the dead of night than during the day.
Cuban revolutionaries went on the right-hand side of the circle.
Then there's the Spaniards themselves, Mr. Moore said. Personally, I like them the best. They remove the kid and keep the mother in the dark, figuring she's not up to being part of it.
And make no announcement of what's happened? Miss Howard said. Why frame our country?